The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first three meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, October 25th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's a city of 7,000 in France, and by the end of this week, it will be no more. It's the sound of migrants and refugees of the Calais temporary city called the Jungle, packing up their possessions and heading to a government processing center to be sent to different locations around France. The three-day operation will erase the shacks and tents crammed into a 1.5-square-mile camp that can possibly be glimpsed from inside the space-age Eurostar trains traveling the Channel Tunnel, linking France and Britain.
The life here is not good, where I was in the jungle.
But the link between these migrants and the UK is not part of the deal, although many wish it were so.
I will sleep on the street if they remove the camp. I will not move one inch from here. Just I have one hope, it's just to get to the UK, and I don't have any other option.
Caroline Gregory has been volunteering for Calais Action for the past year. She says that the somber process of moving once again is underway for these refugees.
Because this has been a while in coming, they're now quite resigned to the fact that the jungle, as it's known, is going to finish. There's also a sense of hopelessness, especially among those who've been here for a long time, maybe up to a year, because they've not managed their goal of getting to the UK, and now they're going to be moved elsewhere in France, where obviously there's no chance at all that they can reach the UK. So among some of them there is definitely a sense of despair and hopelessness.
Why would it be impossible for them to get to the UK if they have some sort of immigrant papers in France so that they could go and apply in Britain? I mean, is the papers that they're going to receive in France ban them essentially from going to the UK?
If they claimed asylum in France, eventually they would be able to travel to the UK. But the problem is that the asylum system is so backed up that it could take years for their papers to come through. So, of course, if you're young or if you've got, for example, even children in the UK, then you're not going to want to wait.
Caroline, how many people have been moved so far, and what does it look like as you're watching?
It's very difficult to say exactly how many people have been moved because there's no official way of counting who goes in, who goes out, whether they're the same people or not. The French authorities are saying that around 2,000 people have gone on the buses so far. But it's difficult to tell, and it's difficult to verify that.
And the actual dismantling of structures, who's responsible for that, and how's that going?
That hasn't really begun yet. So there were been concerns overnight that there are still a lot of children in the camp, even children by themselves. So they haven't actually begun dismantling shelters yet. That's expected to start early tomorrow morning.
Have you spoken with kids? What do they say?
Yes, it's been quite concerning the past couple of days. I've spoken to quite a lot of children in there, and a lot of them are really scared. They don't know. They've not been given proper information by anybody as to what's happening. A lot of them, they don't understand where they're supposed to go to register, and they've been given different information by, for example, the French authorities and the UK volunteers. Some of them are really quite scared as to what their future holds at the moment.
And these are individuals from a variety of countries around the Middle East and North Africa. Give me a sense of the people who you've encountered.
So most of the refugees in the camp are from Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and then Eritrea and Sudan in Africa. Those are the main nationalities. And then there's, you know, some small groups from other places, but those are the main ones.
Have you ever, in the course of your experience there, discovered any sense of radicalization taking place, of individuals who are filled with anger because of their situation and anger that they might take out on their countries of destination?
It is worth remembering that the reason many of these refugees are here is that they are fleeing ISIS, Daesh and the Taliban. So they are even bigger enemies of ISIS than we are in the West. the only chance that they would ever have of becoming radicalised is if the very poor treatment of them here in Europe continues. You know, that's the only thing that I see that could potentially radicalise them.
Carolyn, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Caroline Gregory is a journalist in Calais and a volunteer with Calais Action.
But you say you have another house for all people young. After that, you go to UK, but I don't know.
Al-Aldia, a 14-year-old Sudanese refugee in Calais, is still holding out hope of making it to London. Over 1,000 unaccompanied minors are still waiting to be processed as part of the jungle's demolition. But where do they go? Answering that question is to take a page from the life of Lord Dubs, Labour Party peer in the House of Lords, who was a refugee from the Nazi takeover of Czechoslovakia in 1939. He was part of the Kinder Transport Program. Lord Dubs says only 200 or so have managed to make it through the human pipeline to the UK.
The world has changed enormously. Attitudes to migration, attitudes to refugees have changed. So we're looking at something that's rather different. But have we learned the lessons of the past? Probably not. In 1938-39, Britain took 10,000 unaccompanied child refugees on the Kinder Transport from Germany, Austria and Czechoslovakia, because I was one of them. And at that time, all other European countries said no. And indeed, even the United States, with your very generous immigration policies at that time, even the United States said no to these children. So they all came to Britain.
And as you've seen the situation in Calais, how would you describe the main differences between then and now?
I suppose anybody who is Jewish, I'm half Jewish, was fleeing the Holocaust. So maybe we were fleeing something even more dreadful, which was the gas chambers. However, I've been to Calais twice, and it is very shocking that in a modern, affluent continent like Europe, we have people living in such dreadful squalor. Many young people living in a state of danger, where there are criminals about who can draw them into criminality, prostitution, and so on. So I think it is shocking that we've had the situation in Calais for so long. I'm glad that we're now beginning to do something there.
And what do you make of the insistence that so many of them want to come to the UK?
Well, at one level, it's a little bit puzzling. I think they're saying the chances of getting a job in the UK are greater than getting one in France. I think the people traffickers, some of whom are in the camp in Calais, we believe, have actually said to people, you know, go to the UK. That way they can get some money out of them for helping them across the channel, if that's possible. And partly, I think the authorities, I suppose the French authorities, failed to tell the people arriving in Calais what their rights would be if they stayed in France, their rights to claiming asylum.
You've described how different then is from now. As you look at some of the children in Calais, as you visited, do you see yourself in some of their eyes? Do you see history repeating itself?
Well, you know, it's difficult to describe in words what a dreadful situation it is. Now, look, from my point of view, if I hadn't got out of Czechoslovakia, then I suppose, like a lot of people are Jewish, most people I would have ended up in the gas chambers. So to that extent, I was escaping a terrible fate. On the other hand, my mother simply put me on a train and I was whisked to England on an interminably long train journey. Now, the ones in Calais have had very long, difficult journeys. Some of them have taken a year to get from Middle East or wherever it is. That's what they've said to me. And they're now living in a state where they don't know what the future holds for them. So their present physical situation is abominable, absolutely shocking.
Tell me the story of someone who described their journey and you got a sense of how long their journey has been.
So this is somebody who actually got to England. He got to England illegally on the back of a truck. He was Syrian. I met him on the outside the parliament. He'd seen his family killed by bombs in Damascus. He'd got to Jordan, decided that there was no future for him in a camp in Jordan, and spent a year traveling from Jordan by the complicated route to Calais, and then got himself on the back of a truck and ended up in London. He was speaking a bit of English, and this is a light-hearted bit of relief. He said to me his ambition was to become a politician, pointing at the Palace of Westminster.
Did you express some admiration to that? My goodness, on the back of a truck to screaming in question time, that would be quite a journey in and of itself.
Well, he was about 16. Well, I said to him, you'll have to learn a bit more English so that you can become a politician here. And I said, you better meet a few politicians to make sure they don't change your ambition. But good luck to you. I hope you make it.
I mean, you didn't have any sense talking to this young man that he would become a radicalized militant who would attack Britain.
None at all. I wouldn't have thought so. Look, it's always possible. I've had many supportive emails and letters through my campaign to get unaccompanied child refugees to the UK. But I had one letter. It said, you want these children to come here? They'll all become terrorists like you. So I thought that was gave it a slightly light touch. Unfortunately, the letter was anonymous and I couldn't answer it. But look, on the whole, people are supportive. And I think I met quite a lot of Afghans and Syrians and so on, both in Calais and the ones that have made it here. And they all seem to me people who are bewildered and shocked by their experiences, but who want to make something of their lives, go to school and develop careers and earn money. That's what I think their emotions are now. Obviously, there are people around who want to radicalize impressionable people, and we have to be on the alert for that.
What's your chief worry about the situation in Calais right now and over the next 48 hours?
One of my major concerns is that there's still a lot of children there. They're very vulnerable. Some of them still have the right and can come to this country, and I hope that'll happen quickly. Every day spent there is an intolerable extra day of uncertainty and fear for them. And of course, there's still adults there. And again, they may well be refugees as well, having fled from torture and persecution, threat of torture and death and war and persecution and so on. And I think, frankly, for the people in Calais, it's been a difficult situation because not everybody behaves well and some of them have behaved rather badly. And the people in Calais also don't want this situation to continue.
The Right Honourable Lord Dubs is Labour Party peer in the House of Lords. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Wait a minute. We were essentially denied our constitutional right to a fair trial.
We can give at least some measure of peace to their families who've lost so much.
Certain crimes are considered crimes of moral turpitude.
Whether or not a case can continue to be heard in a court really is a matter of state law.
The whole system has to be thrown out.
The truth needs to be told.
According to the Sentencing Project, 6.1 million Americans are not eligible to vote because of a felony conviction. Some are still in prison, but nearly 4 million have served their sentences and in their attempt to re-enter society find themselves barred from participating in the most basic civic duty. This week, our friends at the Marshall Project take a look at a case filed just last month in Alabama that challenges a provision of the state constitution that allows election registrars to determine voter eligibility for those with a felony conviction based on their own interpretation of what constitutes a crime of, quote, moral turpitude. I'm joined by Andrew Cohen, commentary editor for the Marshall Project and author of the Case in Point series, and Danielle Lang, the deputy director of voting rights at the Campaign Legal Center. Andrew says Alabama's process for re-including veterans into civic life turns out to be a very public humiliation at the hands of some low-level bureaucrats.
Alabama is one of those states that does allow ex-offenders to vote in certain circumstances. And so what you have to do if you've been convicted is you basically apply for registration. You try to register to vote. Basically, the registrar makes a decision based on what your criminal record may be. Certain crimes are considered crimes of moral turpitude. Certain other crimes are not considered crimes of moral turpitude. That phrase is in the Alabama Constitution. And so the problem is that different registrars in different counties have different interpretations about what constitutes a crime of moral turpitude. And you have all these people in the state who have served their time, whether it's been prison or probation or parole. They're trying to re-enter society, and they're trying to vote to become productive members of society. And in certain circumstances, there's no rhyme or reason to why they're being denied the right to vote. For example, you have people who have committed property theft. Many people would not consider that an immoral crime, relatively speaking, and yet those people are being disenfranchised, and that's why this lawsuit was filed last month, essentially saying the whole system has to be thrown out and Alabama has to start again.
Danielle Lang, is there any way of telling what the Constitution wanted to achieve in this screening? Are there particular people who would obviously meet the test of moral turpitude and who would be not eligible to vote?
Well, it is pretty clear what the Constitution wanted to achieve at the time. The language moral turpitude and the disenfranchisement of individuals who've been convicted of crimes, quote unquote, involving moral turpitude, actually dates directly back to the 1901 Alabama Constitution. The drafters were very clear that what they were trying to establish was maintaining white supremacy. That's what they said. And when they were devising the felon disenfranchisement system, they had that specific goal in mind. So by using a vague catch-all term like moral turpitude, they could decide on a case-by-case basis who was allowed to vote based on a criminal conviction and who was not.
Can you give me a sense of the disparities of the kinds of crimes who were approved, and if there is a clear racial distinction between individuals who have felony records of one kind of crime who were allowed to vote and others who weren't, and if their ethnicity had anything to do with it?
The record keeping is just not very good on that, but I can tell you that at the time that this was devised, almost 99% of all of Alabama's prisoners were black. So the criminal justice system at that time was specifically targeting black citizens. And so in the 1901 Constitution, they also had language like wife beating, for example. And one of the drafters said, oh, well, that'll definitely take care of most of the blacks. Now, of course, that wasn't because he thought that that was a crime disproportionately committed by black people, but that that was one that was often used to convict black people in Alabama at that time.
I guess I'm a little bit shocked that something like this, say, a completely arbitrary judgment could be made of someone with a felony conviction at the time of registration, and that there could be such a clear record of racial discrimination going back to 1901. Andrew Cohen, I mean, it seems like this could have been struck down, you know, decades ago.
Yeah, it does, John. I mean, one of the things that struck me is the story of a woman who's actually not a named plaintiff, who was able to get some relief because she ultimately was pardoned. You have a woman who committed a crime, who served whatever the punishment was, and was able to register to vote in a particular county. And there was no problem. She got her registration, and that was that. And then she moved to another county, to Madison County. And when she moved, she was then denied. So not only do you have this racial disparity that I think exists, but you have county-by-county arbitrariness when it comes to enforcing what is supposed to be a state mandate.
I would like to clarify something that I think makes the system even more broken, which is that even to apply to register in Alabama, you have to sign an application that says under penalty of perjury that you have not been convicted of a quote-unquote disqualifying felony. Well, there are a couple things about that. One, as I read it, I would assume that that means that all felonies are disqualifying. But even if I understood that it was supposed to be more limited, there's no way that I could know whether or not my criminal conviction was disqualifying or not. And there is a threat of penalty of perjury if I turn out to be wrong about that decision, which is, frankly, as we've been discussing, an arbitrary one. And so I think that catch-22 for a lot of people with criminal convictions means that very few people are even applying out of fear, even though they may very well be eligible to vote.
In terms of national trends, Andrew Cohen, are states getting away from banning individuals with felony records from voting?
Slowly, John, slowly. Usually governors have broad power to grant pardons or clemency or other relief that gives ex-offenders the right to vote. It's happening in Virginia. This lawsuit is in Alabama. There are other states where we're seeing a little bit of movement. And it sort of goes in line with the Ban the Box movement, which is the movement that does have some national chops to make it easier for ex-offenders to get employment. So there is a movement in that direction, but it's very slow. And in some areas of the country, it's going to be much more difficult than in other areas.
Andrew Cohen is commentary editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point, a biweekly column which sheds light on a single case or character from the criminal justice system. And it's our focus this week. Danielle Lang is the deputy director of voting rights for the Campaign Legal Center. Thanks so much, Danielle and Andrew.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
When the first pitch is thrown at the World Series tonight in Cleveland as the hapless Indians face Chicago's cursed Cubs, the waiting of generations of fans could come to an end. Two teams, two cities, two very different American stories. Today we look back at Chicago, once the city of the stockyards, the railroads, America's original technology city, its big shoulders of steel symbolizing the unstoppable momentum of the industrial age.
Here we are, folks, at Chicago's world-famed Century of Progress, the spectacular fair that was started by a beam of light from the star Arcturus.
That phrase, Century of Progress, was coined for Chicago's legendary world fairs to describe the city's place as a supreme model of human advancement. But progress is something that has always eluded the Chicago Cubs baseball team. The last time the Cubs were in the series, it was 1945. The last time it won the series was 1908, when Chicago historian Russell Lewis says the USA was a very different place than today.
The average wage in the United States was about 22 cents an hour. So if you're working a 40-hour week, you're making about $8.80, somewhere between $200 and $400 a year. Bread was 5 cents a loaf. Eggs were 14 cents a dozen. Coffee was 15 cents a pound. Milk was among the more expensive things, 32 cents a gallon. So it gives you sort of a sense of where people were spending their money.
You can compare the cost of those basics to a pricey 1908 World Series ticket.
General admission tickets were $1. Grandstand seats were $1.50.
Call them Starbucks prices for a seat in the stadium, but nothing like today, where average tickets are going for thousands. Now that's progress. Russell Lewis again, he's chief historian at the Chicago History Museum, says much of Chicago's important history was yet to come back in 1908.
Well, Chicago in 1908 was still a little bit of a rough and tumble town.
Fred Busey was mayor and the city was a microcosm of European bickering and corruption among immigrants and factory workers, most of them white in 1908.
People were not particularly well educated. Of course, most people had not gone to college. If anything, they had finished a high school education. There was still a fairly large percentage of illiterate people in Chicago. People did not have indoor plumbing. There were still ghetto-like, tenement-like areas of Chicago where, you know, they were really overcrowded and people were sort of struggling. The city was very polluted, both by the refuse on the street as well as smoke, coal, coal-fired boilers and things like that.
Russell Lewis says, in particular, Chicago's African-American history chapter was still unwritten.
The Great Migration had not really happened, so Chicago's African-American population had not really grown the way it did beginning around 1915 through the 1960s. So it was still a relatively small African-American population that lived on the west side with some on the south side. Neighborhoods were very distinct and very segregated by ethnicity and religion, and people did not partake of other neighborhoods and other people's cultures. So everybody was very much segregated, left to their own ways of life.
When African Americans did arrive in Chicago, they started their own baseball team, the American Giants, and for years it was the most dominant team in the famous Negro Leagues. When the Giants disbanded, it was the American League Chicago White Sox who claimed the loyalty of the Southside African American fans. Everybody loved baseball in Chicago, and Lewis says they all had their own teams.
Baseball was really extremely popular, and I think it really cut across the ethnic groups. I think a lot of ethnic people found in baseball, you know, one of the ways they could participate in being an American. So it was, you know, very much about owning that identity. And of course, it was exciting as well, but you could go to the ballpark or you could be outside or you could read about it in the papers and you could participate in something that rang true for Americans and, you know, rang true for Chicago in terms of Chicago pride.
That was real progress for baseball, because what are the surprising facts about the last time the Cubs won the series?
It was the lowest attended World Series in history.
Russell Lewis says in 1908, the Cubs were a dynasty. They had won the series the year before, and ticket brokers got a little greedy. The Cubs had become an exclusive club, and it was a turnoff.
Part of it was because it was a repeat, and I think there was a little bit of a sense from the public that the players weren't completely all in terms of the game. But in Chicago, there was also a ticket scalping scandal that upset a lot of the Chicagoans, and they actually boycotted the games. The way the scandal worked is people waited in line at the Spalding Sporting Goods store as well as the ballpark to buy tickets, and a lot of the tickets then were sold to people who had, you know, so-called reserved them, and these were scalpers. So it did have people in Chicago pretty upset, and as I said, a number of fans boycotted the second game that was in Chicago.
Historian Lewis notes that these days Major League Baseball is having some of the same troubles with falling ratings and soaring ticket prices that were the case more than a century ago, which he personally would not call progress.
It's changed so dramatically. When I came to Chicago in 1980 and started going to Wrigley Field, I usually went to the ballpark with $3, and I spent $2 on a bleacher seat and $1 on a beer. And, you know, today the beer alone is $10, so that sort of shows my age and how much things have changed.
But the Cubs have a real chance to exorcise all the demons and curses and redeem themselves in this World Series for the whole city of Chicago. And to everyone's amazement, the Cubbies are really that good.
Ultimately, you know, it's really not about the Billy Goats, it's not about the Black Cats. The reason that this team is winning and is in the World Series is just because they are so good.
Russell goes to Baez, one, over to first. The Cubs are going to the World Series. The Cubs win the pennant.
And tomorrow we'll bring you a postcard from the city of Cleveland, way back when, to their last World Series win in the year 1948. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity brain training with games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. From scientists and game designers exploring new ways to research human cognition. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by Staples, offering a variety of printer ink and toner cartridges for home and business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Will 2016 be the most scrutinized election in modern American history? With Donald Trump sowing suspicion about stolen elections and fears about wildly inaccurate pre-election polling, along with voter suppression tactics in some southern states and counties, how can we know the true picture on Election Day? The good news is that big data and social media collection are better than ever, and that teams of watchers are going to be looking at what's happening in new ways all across the country this year. Derek Willis is a news applications developer at ProPublica, focusing on politics and elections, and his team will provide real-time analysis of the vote on Election Day.
The amount of real-time data that's available to us or will be available to us on Election Day isn't that great in the sense that there are very few formal channels that come from the government, for example. But there are some places that we can look to kind of get a sense of how things are going. One of those, obviously, are social media platforms, because people do tend to take to those to express any frustrations or issues. And so that opportunity and that ability exists also for Election Day. So that'll be one part of it. The other part of it comes from Google searches. If there are long lines, or if it seems like, you know, you're at the wrong polling location, or there are questions you have about the voting process, one of the things we do now is hop on Google and ask these kinds of questions.
Are you in a position to deputize voters to actually tell you of their experience and use that in real time to post?
On our election land site, we've actually asked if voters just want to tell us what their experience is like. We would definitely love to have that be a part of our system. Obviously, we realize that that's not going to be a comprehensive selection of voters. It's going to be only people who are aware of us and who opt in, you know, choose to tell us about what their experience is like. But we certainly would love to hear from people, particularly if they encounter problems or questions in regards to their own voting experience on election day.
What do you envision as a fully technology-enabled electoral environment if you could wave a magic wand?
Having local and state election officials be able to and willing to publish information about the state of the vote, how things are sort of going from an election administration perspective. And here's an example of what I mean by that. If during the day, for example, counties and states were able to willing to publish how many provisional ballots were issued, you know, at each polling location or at each even in each county, that would tell us something about sort of whether or not the vote was proceeding in a way that was fairly normal and typical, or there might be something unusual going on there.
Can you envision a day where states would have control, but they would have to meet certain standards that would allow an American citizen to click on a county, click on a city, and get real-time election data and call up their, you know, brother and say, hey, it looks like Trump's winning in your hometown, pal, and that could enrich the democratic experience on election day? Or do you think that would just be too scary and open everything up to manipulation?
I think having it be sort of broadly available down to a pretty finite geographic jurisdiction is probably some ways off. And I think there's a lot of conversations we have to have before we get to that sort of state.
Derek Willis is news applications developer at ProPublica, focusing on politics and elections. He spoke with us from Washington, D.C. Derek, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
On November 8th, Derek Willis and Election Land will be bringing us the latest from polling places around the country. If you want to participate in the Election Land project, visit projects.propublica.org/electionland. The deadline to sign up is November 6th.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Here's a real Veterans Day story as the official day approaches. When the California National Guard was having difficulty making its recruitment targets to Iraq and Afghanistan for foot soldiers, the U.S. Army offered a signing bonus for soldiers who promised to redeploy. $15,000, $20,000 in cash to go back to wars that by then were not going well. Nearly 10,000 soldiers took the offer, and most of them also redeployed. Now the Pentagon wants the money back after an investigation, and audits have revealed that California Guard officials overpaid and may have committed fraud to meet enlistment targets. With interest and other fines, the bills add up to far more than the original payouts. Veterans argue that they and their families are facing serious financial hardship, and the fact that they deployed as promised means the Army is not holding up its end of the deal. Bob DeAndrea is one of those veterans. He's a retired major with the U.S. Army Reserve who served in the California National Guard. He's currently a sergeant with the Santa Monica Police Department. He remembers the deal clear as day.
It was really simple. I was an infantry officer. The bonus was for infantry officers to stay in an additional 6 years. During that six-year period to deploy at least once. I qualified for the bonus or the incentive, and I accepted it. It was that easy. I was with a bunch of other officers. We all got the same briefing. We're all told we were eligible. We signed up. We got the money. Shortly after that, I deployed again to Iraq. I finished out the six-year contract, stayed in the Guard for another year and a half, and then retired. Didn't think anything of it.
How much money are we talking about here?
In my case, it's $20,000.
And you did deploy, right? I mean, that was the understanding.
Yes.
So the dispute stems from not disclosing the bonus?
No, the dispute comes from the actual bonus contract. There wasn't a copy of it in my personnel file. In other words, they didn't have a copy of my contract.
They just lost it or something.
Well, there's a little bit more to that. There were four individuals that were convicted of fraud against the federal government related to the incentives program. One of them destroyed thousands of records in the process. That being said, the California National Guard isn't known for their ability to actually do administrative and other leadership skills very well. It's very, very common to not have things placed into your record, to have documents lost, to resubmit documents over and over again, to get them into your personnel file. Essentially, just a lack of oversight in the organization.
What recourse do you have to keep the Pentagon from essentially collecting that $20,000 debt? And I understand interest is accumulating along with it.
And that's just the aggravating part. That's the whole issue here, in my opinion. They provide you with phone numbers and offices to go to and legal assistance. And then it turns out the phone numbers don't work. The websites don't work. The offices are closed. The JAG officers, the Army attorneys that they assigned to assist soldiers with this, were disbanded and reassigned. Every avenue that I go to asking for help tells me that they can't help me. And then it's long turnarounds to hear back that they can't help me.
So what recourse do you have at this point?
Right now, I'm working with a civilian attorney who's helping me out pro bono. And after the big Army, the Army Board of Corrections, sent me a letter stating that they could not look at my file until I've exhausted all California options, which I already thought I did. I went back to California and I started all over again. I went to the Inspector General. I had to get a letter from them saying that they couldn't help me. The AG, get a letter from them saying that they can't help me. I'm now waiting for one more letter from the National Guard Bureau to tell me that they can't help me so I can go back to the big Army and resubmit. The problem is, last time I submitted it, it took a year for them just to review it and tell me that they weren't going to look at it.
You're currently employed with the Santa Monica Police, right?
Correct.
And you investigate financial crimes, is that true?
I did. I was a financial crimes investigator for just over 4 years, almost 5 years.
What an irony to be involved in this with the National Guard and with the Pentagon.
And that was another big part of frustration here. I can show beyond a reasonable doubt that I was qualified for this bonus, that based on the circumstances and all the other documentation that I have, that the only thing that's missing is a copy of my contract, but I can prove that I was eligible for the bonus. I can prove that something was sent to the Army in order to pay me the bonus and that I served my end of the commitment. I received the audit packet, and this was no audit. This was a check the box. Nobody really did any looking. Nobody called me to ask questions. Nobody went through my personnel file and did some analysis. It was pretty insulting.
You know, when do you expect, if ever, this will end?
I expect that unless something happens in Congress or some of the senior leadership in California step up and make some things happen, it's going to take until I finally get to the final phase, the Army Board of Corrections, which is seems to be the only one that can absolve these debts, until I finally get my day where they review my packet.
And no idea when that would happen.
And there's no idea when that would happen.
What do other veterans say about this and about the question of their service versus the bonus versus the, you know, in tough times, you know, all government agencies want to have their money back if they think they're entitled to it.
Right. But it's, you know, it's kind of interesting. You talk to civilians, come up to me and talk, or people I've talked to in the civilian sector, and they're just completely perplexed by this. It's like, wait, you did your end of the bargain and now they want their money back because they don't have their copy of the contract. Well, that's their problem. And I'm like, yeah, exactly. Civilian attorneys point out, how can they do this? This is outside the statute of limitations. And how can they just start taking your money from you? That doesn't make any sense. You should get your day in court. Military service members are very angry. They can't fathom it. And they can't understand why there's no process in place to help us get that due process.
Bob DeAndrea is a retired major with the U.S. Army Reserve who served in California's National Guard. He's currently a sergeant with the Santa Monica Police Department. Thanks so much, Bob.
Thank you for the time.
In the Shakespeare play Julius Caesar, Mark Antony asks a question that echoes down to our time.
Was this ambition?
Ambition, what is it? In our time, it's a kind of hope, I think. People taking on the impossible, the unimaginable, grasping up the vertical wall of the seemingly impossible. We want to spend some time on this program celebrating the impulses of the wildly ambitious. We begin with someone who 14 years ago was written about this way, quote, he's got his sights on higher, much higher things than mere laughs, on a whole series of themes so weighty that any one of them would be enough to give considerable heft to an ordinary novel. That was the New York Times review by Francine Prose for novelist Jonathan Safran Foer, his very first novel, Everything is Illuminated. Foer, it turns out, is up to the challenge.
You know, I want to go at everything when writing a book, just as one wants to go at everything when reading a book. We want, for the time that we're inside of the world of a book, for it to feel like a complete experience.
His new book, Here I Am, places the reader in the middle of a failing marriage, a crumbling planet, and a national crisis that forces civilization to rethink its identity through religion. Somehow the story of Jacob and Julia Block and their three sons, quarantined into 4 short weeks, feels like an epic. But it's more than worthy of the devilishly clever laughs Jonathan Safran Foer gives us.
You know, there's a lot of cultural specificity in this book, a lot more than I think any of my other books. But the things that I was writing, that I felt that I was writing about, and you know, you know what I was writing about as well as I know what I was writing about, but the things I felt like I was writing about were not in any way specifically Jewish or specifically American or specifically contemporary, but ideas of home, ideas of conflicting identities and the pain that that causes one to have. You know, the knowledge that we are not in any one place in our lives, but in not only multiple places, but places that are often competing with each other as a parent, as a professional, as a person in a relationship, as a person who has perhaps some religious ideas or values and then secular ideas or values, and the ways that those things rub against each other. And that's what I felt like I was writing about. And I, you know, used the resources that I had. And Judaism is a big resource for me in terms of the stories that I can appeal to, a kind of vernacular, it's my way of being.
The voice in this book, and I won't call it you, but is someone who has a huge joy about the feast that is possible in life right now. You've got Second Life and you've got Israel and you've got media and all these various things. Did you ever experience Second Life, this kind of digital parallel world, directly?
I didn't, but I have to say I absolutely love that description of the book. That's how I feel about it, and that's how I feel about the characters. You know, one could easily say it's a book about like things dissolving or breaking apart or fragmenting, and I don't think of it that way at all. I think of it as a very like hopeful and optimistic book about people who are hungry. So Sam, the oldest child who's 13, spends an awful lot of his waking hours in this game called Other Life, but you refer to it as Second Life because – you know, it is somewhat like Second Life. I haven't spent a lot of time there, but I wanted to give him an elsewhere. Each of the characters has an elsewhere. Jacob has an elsewhere in an affair, mm-hmm. and an elsewhere in this sort of secret artistic project he's working on. Julia, his wife, who's an architect, has an elsewhere in these homes that she designs for herself, imaginary homes that she'll never end up living in. But the challenge for all of these people is how to just be where you are, not even to find contentedness, which I think is an unrealistic goal or sounds a little flaky, but how to simply be present where you are and say, where my body is, my mind also is.
At the center of this book is a marriage. And the qualities that divide this couple are things that they think about each other, expectations that they have for each other, which is the way a marriage typically works. But what brings them together are things that they share without thinking, the space of the world, all right, we've got to stop talking about that and deal with this earthquake or whatever's happening. It was so hopeful how these two come together when they need to.
It's hopeful and it's tragic, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they operate on two levels, like the level of living and doing and then the level of thinking and feeling. And so on the level of living and doing, they're great. Like they are constantly getting closer. They're getting better at, you know, fulfilling what's required of them as partners and as parents, whether grocery shopping, cooking, cleaning up, coordinating schedules, thinking about the kids together in, you know, caring ways. And but then on the level of the sort of primitive or the desire, they become alienated from each other and from themselves.
Is that to say that parenthood and that kind of teamwork in a marriage is unfulfilling?
No, not at all. But it might be to say that a certain kind of closeness can preclude another kind of closeness. I know somebody who was with the same person for decades and decades. And I said, what was the secret? How'd you make that work? And she said, there's always something unknowable about him. There's always something that was mysterious, some distance I couldn't cross. So you would think that might be the explanation for why something didn't work. But what she had was this space that was beckoning. And I think the tragedy in this relationship in the book between Jacob and Julia is that there was no original sin. No, nobody wronged the other. They can't explain what the origin of the distance between them or which became a withholding was, other than maybe a certain kind of closeness.
Who says, "Here I am," the title of this book?
Oof. I don't know. I'm not really sure.
It's from the Bible.
Oh, well, in that sense, literally, it refers to the story of the binding of Isaac, which begins, and then God put Abraham to the test. He said, "Abraham, Abraham," said, "Here I am." And God said, "I need you to sacrifice your beloved son." So the sort of obvious interpretation of that passage is that the test is the sacrifice, but maybe it's just simply, how will you respond? And when I was puzzled by your question, who says, "Here I am," I'm not sure. It's certainly what Jacob is striving to do. And there's a moment at the end when he says, the final words of the book are, "I'm ready." And it seems like he is ready to claim an identity, but I'm not sure if readers will agree with him.
But what an audacious thing to say at the beginning of a huge piece of work like this. I mean, you're going for broke.
Well, you know, what else is there to go for? I did the best that I could in a very personal way. And now, you know, going out into the world with it and having to talk about it, it feels sometimes like I'm talking about it in a language that is completely other from the one in which I wrote it. I mean, in the sense of what, you know, you opened this interview by talking about ambition. Even the notion of that word being passed between two people feels so strange to me because the ambition was so personal, you know, from the first word to the last.
Well, that's you all over. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciated this conversation.
Jonathan Safran Foer is the Lillian Vernon Distinguished Writer in Residence at the Creative Writing Program at New York University, author of the novels Everything is Illuminated and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, and most recently, Here I Am, in bookstores now. And here's something to take with you today in the annals of multitasking. This new telescope has no rivals. A 38,000-horsepower silent vibration-proof engine. It's got a giant high-tech mirror. It was unveiled this week in the White Sands base of New Mexico. The Space Surveillance Telescope, it's called, is capable of watching 10,000 little pieces of killer space junk simultaneously. It's bound for Australia to cover a blind spot in the sky. The DARPA lab that developed the scope is surely concerned about some killer meteor, but you have to wonder if they were also scared to death by this movie scene from Gravity.
Oh, we lost you. Lost you, Graf. Look, we need to get the hell out of here.
Need some help there, man.
No, don't wait for us.
It's stuck.
Man down. Man down.
Preventing that, now that's ambition. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
RI, Public Radio International.